Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
And Mrs. Future here. In this hour, we're going to discuss a couple of our favorite topics, the future of health, future of healing, and the future of community. And to help us with that, besides the likes of us, is Reverend Julia Bastrova, MA, who's been working in the healing field for some time now. She's a healer, a body worker, practices the laying on of hands, Eastern modalities, meditation. She's a real Renaissance woman in the healing world.
And a scientist.
Yes, very scientific in her approach. And a synthesis of Eastern and Western processes. But just to give you an idea, check out this testimonial. Julia is much more than a therapist. She's a master healer. She holds the deep realms of emotional and energetic healing while tending to the physical being. I highly recommend her, Melissa Patterson, naturopathic doctor. So we're bringing Julia on specifically at this point because she had just come back from a rather profound experience being at Standing Rock for a month or so, and how that came down both in terms of community and the experience of a collaborative healing experience with other therapists.
And of course, we were tuned in via some of the live posts that were happening through Facebook and through other kinds of social media. And Julia's reports from that were really insightful, very encouraging, you know, sort of a light in the darkness there. So we thought we'd bring her in.
So Julia, are you there?
Yes, here I am.
Yeah, there she is.
Hi, honey.
Oh, what happened to your voice?
It's a little hoarse because I have unfortunately contracted this, what we call the DAPL cough, that DAPL meaning the Dakota Access Pipeline. Anyway, there is this bronchial thing that was going around camp, and I know a lot of people that came down with it, and I am one of them.
Oh, dear. Well,
yeah.
Okay, well, let us know if it gets hard for talking. We'll go to a commercial or something.
Okay,
fill in the blank. But,
okay, well, you're based out of the Sebastopol area. You know what? How did you decide that you wanted to go up to Spirit Rock? What brought you in that direction?
To Standing Rock.
Standing Rock, excuse me.
Yeah. Well, I just felt an inner calling to go back in early summer, actually. Maybe even sooner than that, but it was a very compelling call from within.
That you just needed to be there?
Yeah, that I was to go there. And subsequently, after when I finally did get there, I wasn't able to go as soon as I had the call because I had other obligations I had to attend to.
Sure.
However, when I finally did get there and talked to other people and asked them why they were there, interestingly enough, consistently and across the board, pretty much everybody I knew that was really there, that was like really, truly there in a committed way.
They had a calling as well in that sense, right?
Yeah, had all had the same kind of calling.
And so would you think of yourself as responding to a prayer or, you know, how would you...
It's like a ministry, being calling to the service of the divine in some way?
I definitely saw it as a ministry, but I kind of an unconventional minister in that sense. I guess I see everything I do as a ministry.
That's right. You're not classically any one particular religion, from what I know about you. You've combined Eastern and Western approaches.
Well, I am an ordained minister, interfaith minister, which I do have a Christian background, but interfaith minister is somebody that seeks to understand many belief systems, especially the main monotheistic beliefs, but all beliefs, and to promote dialogue between them, to promote ways of understanding each other.
When you went up to Standing Rock, were you expecting to apply some of those skills there and helping to resolve differences that...
Yes, I went there specifically actually to do healing work and to work with people in trauma.
Any physical trauma or mental?
All of it. It's all, yeah.
What we saw here was that there was some conflagrations that happened and some people got hurt and some people got really cold and they probably need to be treated for that physically. But you're saying that there were some psychological trauma that was going there as well?
Well, there's many layers of things happening there. So probably one of the deeper layers is the historical trauma of just what's been going on between the white Western colonialism and the indigenous people. Mm. So as I'm sure you know, there's a huge amount of trauma that has occurred over a long time on the indigenous people, and yeah. They've been not only massacred, but we've had their culture, try to school their culture out of them or kill the culture. You know, for a long time, it was not even legal for them to speak their own language. I could go on and on.
But there's evidence of that subjugation even 100 years later.
Very alive and still very much there. That's the thing. And we see that evident in the treatment of the natives by the police, how they target them, how they treat them.
Hmm. So it's really quite a class warfare still going on there.
It's very much a class warfare. It's really sobering. Hmm. And it was sobering for me, especially being a quote-unquote white person.
Yeah. Can we hold that for a second right there? Because we got to go to a commercial break. And okay. We'll be right back to talk what that experience is. This is the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to Julia Bustrova on her experiences at Standing Rock.
And the future of community. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Julia Bustrova about her experiences at Standing Rock as a healer. Now, can you paint the picture a little bit for us what it was like to arrive there, Julia? Was it like Burning Man, where there were camps?
Well, it's funny you should say that because, you know, in trying to describe it to people, there are definitely some aspects about it that the closest thing I could find to compare it to is Burning Man, having been to Burning Man a number of times.
Sure.
But I don't think that does it service, honestly, because there were people that were from Burning Man that came at one point when the camp was really swelling up with all the attention that we were getting from the media. And so a lot of people were coming, and they were coming without really connecting into the real deeper purpose of the movement. And
almost like tourists?
Like tourists and Burning Man people coming thinking it's kind of like Burning Man. And it was really not. So the similarity is that we are camping in the elements, and it's harsh, very, very, very harsh elements. And you have to be sustainable. You have to really kind of come fully prepared for the elements. So in that way, it's very similar to Burning Man. The other similarity is that it's no buying and selling. It's all gift economy. And so that's the other similarity.
So no money in the camp.
Yeah, no money in the camp. It's all donations and people just giving of from their heart. It's really quite beautiful.
Oh, good. How was the food handled, for example?
Yeah, so this was just a big gift. People would donate food. Also, there's a lot of money that people have donated. And so with that money, the people in charge of the kitchens would go buy food, what they needed. But there are several kitchens set up in different places, and they would just cook until they ran out or whatever for the evening.
Now, one person asked me, what was the mix of people? Was it a lot of Native Americans, or was it mostly Californians and New Agers? Or, you know, how would you define the attendees?
Well, I found that people from, like, California, like me, sharply dropped off as it got colder.
As it got colder. All the white people started to leave.
Yeah, most of the white people I met, no, actually not a lot of white people, but they were all from like Wisconsin and Michigan and Canada or something, you know, just like an equally cold place.
They stayed on? Or they were ready for the cold, more so, I guess.
Yeah. There was even some like really awesome Norwegians there. Boy, do they know how to do cold.
I bet. No, you were mentioning just before the break about arriving, and you started talking about a little bit about being a white person coming into a native situation, and that you were experiencing what might be described as white guilt for what we did to the Indians?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, it was a very humbling experience for me that continues to evolve as the realization deepens. Really, what has happened with, you know, colonialism and the indigenous and my you know, my white skin and how I've inherited from that a certain privilege and entitlement that I've taken for granted and that I've now become so much more acutely aware of.
But you took for normal, you can see other people are seeing as a privilege.
Yeah, for example, it wouldn't have occurred to me that I walk in a restaurant and somebody would attend to me right away, right? Or something like that, or some other store. And that's not necessarily true all the time for a person with brown skin or black skin. And they go in and they may have to wait, or they may not be waited on at all.
So you're not even aware of that there's that hierarchy going on.
Yeah, and I'm not aware. I wasn't. So yeah, there's many other examples I could give. That's just one easy one.
Did being in this situation help you process that white guilt? Did you reach a new level of awareness of how to connect with the Native population, for example?
Yeah, well, you know, what was really cool about the camp and also very humbling is that it's Native-centered.
Yeah.
And it honors the Native. There are indigenous tribes from all over the world. There are over 300. I don't even know how many. But tribes from everywhere have sent representatives to the camp. And all the Natives were held and honored as, you know, in a way. Uh-huh. And the white people are kind of like the, you know, we're like the servants, you know, we're there to be allies and to serve.
Yeah. Kind of reversal of roles in one way.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so it took a bit of adjustment. And I saw a lot of white people struggle with this, actually. I don't know, you know, and some of them probably never even got to the other end of it. And those usually end up leaving.
Well, if you're used to being on top and you're suddenly treated like a servant, they said, WTF, you know? I mean,
yeah, people. and it's also just the way we do things as and we're not talking about just white skin. It's also a colonial kind of Western way of doing things, which is also conditioned into many skin colors, right? You know, so, but that way of doing things is what's being turned around as well. And that actually, this is a really good subject because that will relate to the overall topic about community, which is that how they do things there is, I come in as a woman that's used to organizing things and planning, and I have my agenda and all this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how we're taught to get things done in this society. Well, it's, you know, I was quickly corrected on as far as that goes, because this is not about having your agenda and it's not about implementing your plan. It's about actually just listening and being and allowing and serving and just being in the moment. And it's very different. It's much more of a kind of natural, nature-based, connective, relational way of being. And after I got the idea, okay, this is what we're doing, and I humbled myself and realized that my agenda didn't matter. What I came there, I was there to do didn't matter. What mattered was listening and seeing how I best could serve.
Yeah.
And so when I got into the groove with that, that's when it really started getting very interesting. And
How long did that take?
I saw what community could really be.
So the big transition, how long did that take? A week or so?
Yeah, maybe.
And how long were you there for?
Almost a month.
Wow.
And I am going back. I'm still there in a way. I'm still staying in connection and helping them in whatever way I can from over here.
So how did you find your place there? So you came and you had to tune into the situation, what was going on. And you being a healer, you probably were looking for other healers or ways in which you could help or assist in that nebble initially, I would imagine.
Well, I already was connected ahead of time with with Medic Camp and the Healers Council. I didn't go through the form. They have a formal process. You do that. I kind of went in the back door. But I had a friend that raised money for yurts, and she and I were planning to go there together, meet up there, and she put the yurts together, and they were donated to the Medic Camp. And so we ended up sleeping in them, one of them, and helping get the other set up for, and that was the wellness center. That was the Wellness Community Bodywork yurt. I just immediately was just brought right into the center of all the activity in the Medic Camp, which is right in the center of the whole Standing Rock camp itself. The Medic Camp is like a really great way to see what's going on the front lines.
I imagine so. And I imagine also it's a good place to really meet other healers from around the world.
Absolutely. You wouldn't believe some of the incredible healers I met from every kind of healer, chiropractors and naturopaths and MDs and nurses and acupuncturists and energy workers and just every kind of healer.
Did you teach each other stuff once you were together, or did you?
There was some of that, but to be honest, we're too busy.
Really? dealing with real health issues?
And that goes back to the question that I think I didn't answer originally, which is about trauma.
Yes.
Which there is a lot of trauma. So there's this historical trauma, but there's also trauma that's getting personal trauma, right? We all have our own personal trauma to some degree or another, you know, and that environment, and especially if you are a protector on the front lines and you're getting beat up by the police or arrested or even just watching people beat up, you are going to have some trauma. And what that does is it actually can activate personal trauma that you have already in your system.
Or re-stimulate what's already in your system.
And so people with PTSD or whatever, you know, that it gets stimulated. So then it opens the door to all this other stuff that you need support around.
Yes. And speaking of PTSD, I remember in your reports that there's a large contingent of veterans that went there.
Yes.
And can we ask you about that? We have to go to a CBS News break. Can you stay on the line? We'll be back in 5 minutes. Okay, thank you. This is KSEO, Dr. Future Show. You're listening to Jewel Bestrova on her experiences as a healer at Standing Rock.
And the future of community.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Welcome back, Mrs. Future. Welcome back, Julia.
Hello.
We are speaking with Julia Bestrova on her experiences at Standing Rock in North Dakota over the pipeline issue that, of course, needs no introduction.
Yeah. One thing, Julia, I'm interested in is your perspective of if there were any miracles there that you witnessed or experienced.
Oh, yeah. There are many miracles that I've heard of that I didn't directly witness that were rather significant in terms of what I saw directly. Let's see. I'd have to think about that for a bit. You caught me off guard, but I...
She was talking about the stories of the veterans arriving. I think
To me, that was one of those miracles, but why I was thinking of that question.
That American veterans in mass would show up at Standing Rock in support
that
of the...
That definitely was a huge...
That was a tidal shift, right?
Huge thing that happened. It was pretty overwhelming, though, to the camp. The camp wasn't quite able to handle that many people.
Well, give us a quick little synopsis of the story, because maybe there may be people in our audience who aren't as familiar with the events at Standing Rock as we are.
So you were at a camp, maybe, what is it, about 10,000 people, and you were helping people who were in the front lines, and there were probably people up 24 hours a day there. There were ceremonial fires, and then the veterans arrived, and there were like several thousand people all at once.
Yeah, over a few period of, probably over a week, but the few days right before the 4th, they really started coming in, and they were coming in on these big buses.
You had to prepare for food and lodging and shelter?
Well, I don't know all the details of everything, because it's a little hard to get a unified scenario, because there are just different groups of them. There's so many of them that there are different groups of them, kind of hubs of them.
Yeah.
But what I understand is that Wesley Clark Jr., the son of the well-known retired NATO commander, whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he's the one that, him and this other guy, I don't remember his name, but they did a call out to the vets to show up and then raised money. And so many more came than they expected, I believe. And they were told to come prepared, but I think a lot of them didn't.
And so you had to pick up the slack for that.
Yeah, and so there were many vets that, you know, didn't have places to sleep or food or things like that. So that was challenging. And then Wesley Clark Jr. left after the 5th or something, when the blizzard came in, and he left, and the money wasn't used to help the vets, even though it was meant for them. And I've heard different stories about that. So a lot of vets were very disgruntled, thinking that he took the money and ran. But I also heard that they were having trouble getting the money from the bank because the accounts were getting frozen for whatever reason. They were making it hard to get the money.
What happened, though, is that they created a tide shift that I believe it wasn't long after that Obama decided to put an end to it all.
Yeah, but that wasn't really... That's the thing. That's the thing the media wants us all to think, that there's an end to it all, but it hasn't ended. And in fact, if anything, it hurt the cause, because this is my personal opinion, and I know I'm not the only one who has this, but that what it did is we did need to have so many people leave because there was just too many people.
And not enough resources.
It also scattered the camp, and it made everybody think, oh, we've succeeded, now we can go.
You mean it's over? Oh, it's not? Oh, you mean it is? It isn't? I see.
Meanwhile, the pipeline guys pretty much beefed up their camp.
You mean getting ready to continue the construction process?
No, they did continue this construction process, and they have actually been building a military base with the drill site. So they have no intention of letting up.
Or rerouting?
Yeah, they have no intention of rerouting. I don't know where that's at now, but at the time, after this announcement from the Army Corps of Engineers, they responded saying, no, we're sticking here, we're going to drill here. And they just figure that when Trump gets into office, that he'll just give them carte blanche some form or fashion, and they'll continue on their merry way.
Offer the natives some more money, and it'll just go away.
So is there no kind of formal political process here, except just like, you know, brute force, whoever pays for the biggest army is going to win?
It sure seems that way. They have obviously a lot of money, and they have a lot of people in their pockets. We're up against a very huge power.
Now, some people are saying that the "we" that you're talking about is actually that there's some division, you know, among the native land proprietors themselves, that there is a small group of entrepreneurial natives who are actually the ones that are benefiting. And then there is a larger group of natives who didn't get cut into the deal who are the ones protesting. And then around that little civil dispute, we have the whole media circus and all of the other third parties coming in and picking up their roles. Is that something that sounds familiar to you?
I don't know the details of that. I'm sure there have been, and I know there have been, you know, dissensions among the natives' own leadership and people that have maybe perhaps been bought out or whatever. But, you know, that's such a tried and true method.
Yeah.
War, right? Divide and conquer or whatever.
Well, let's really look at where it was most meaningful for you, because
what I want to say is that this, regardless, I mean, we can get drawn off into all the dramas of who, what, where, when.
Easily.
But the real issue is that there's this pipeline, and it will pollute the water. It's not about if it spills, it's about when. Mm-hmm. And it's also about the treaty rights and the land rights there. So it's about sovereignty. And this is something that all the natives agree on, whether or not they are, you know, we question where their loyalty lies, but they all agree on that. And it's also interesting to note that you may or may not have heard the prophecy that's, I couldn't find it anywhere written. I think it might be oral.
Yes, I have heard about a prophecy there about a black snake.
About the black snake, a Sitting Bull talked about a black snake coming through, and that his people had to cut the head off of the black snake, or else that would be the beginning of the end of our planet, basically. So
yes, now how many people took that to heart as the mythology of the place?
Oh, yeah. This is seen as life and death. This is really seen very, very much as we have to do this no wiggle room.
Mm. Now, this kind of having to do this brought together like a cauldron, all of you folks, to really stand for this confrontation, if you will.
Yeah, and the reason I have huge sympathy, and I also supportive and serve the Native interests of what they're doing, but obviously it's not my direct battle as much, but it is a bigger battle, I think, for all of humanity, what we're doing in trying to get off of fossil fuel. And really, that's kind of the bigger, this is what's being played out there, is I believe what is needing to be played out all over the planet. And it's like, if we invest in another pipeline, basically that's saying we're investing in another 50 years or whatever of oil.
Right.
And really, it just puts another nail in our coffin. So we can't keep investing in these pipelines. We need to put that money into alternative energy sources.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and we just did some stories about how the real turning point for that is this year, where it's becoming as economic to go solar as it is to go gas oil. So the economics are beginning to speak in favor of the new paradigm as well.
The reason why I was talking about the miracles is because the things I remembered from your firsthand reports were big moments after some violent confrontations where there were actual peaceful, prayerful moments and where there seemed to be a coming together of the humanity of the people who were present on both sides, such as in the prayer when the women came together to cross the bridge to lead the prayer circle. I'm most interested in the idea that there is some common ground for humanity to solve this problem without it being a violent confrontation between the haves, the have-nots, the power elites. This is not Avatar, where we have corporations against the nature-loving natives. It's really a very different scenario of modern humans and how we all are needing to let go of our own personal shadows and come together for a bigger human conversation where everybody who's on the planet is treated as a meaningful life form that needs to be supported and nourished, and that the environment needs to be kept for us all. So we need to go back to some of the ideals of the past and carry them forward and not act like we're going to go backwards to a time where we have race wars determining the outcome. You know? We have to go forward to a time where all humanity is united under the banner of one world.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's the ideal that I think we are moving towards. And it seems to me that, at least at this time in our evolution, more often than not, crisis brings us together.
Yeah, why is that? Why can't we have something else to bring us together instead of crisis?
Yeah, that's the question I'd like to answer. It seems to bring out the best in us. When we feel this pressure from around us, we come together, and the kindness comes out and the miracles happen that you're talking about. I have been asking that question, well, how do we do this without crisis? How can we come together? And that would be the ideal community scenario. I believe we're getting there, but honestly, I don't see that it'll happen before at least a good threshold number of us are healed enough within our own person, that our own trauma is healed enough that we aren't needing to continue to act out in ways.
I see. So our own trauma gets in the way of our ability to have a functional community.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
So
well, let's continue on that after the break. We got one more break, Julia, and then we'll be right back.
Yeah. Okay. Great subject to talk about. Okay. After the trauma, how do we proceed healed? Dr. Future Show, we'll be right back.
Hi, Dr. Pete Kiesling here on KSCO. You know, the stockings are hung at the fireplace, and I know the cat will be checking Christmas morn to see if Santa has been to the Kiesling house. Peg and I wish you all a very Merry Christmas and the healthiest and happiest of New Year's.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Oh, this is so good. I'm playing with this new back massager I got from my sister-in-law. Heats and everything, and oh, it really makes you feel good.
A happy back. Oh, it's a happy Dr. Future.
So, speaking of feeling good, Julia Bystrova, our guest on this hour, is talking about the experiences she had at Standing Rock, and especially in relation to the future of community. In our final segment here, Julia, let's look a little bit about what that future community might actually look like, given all that you've learned over the last
Where are we going and how do we get there from here?
As an eco-village or something like that?
Absolutely. And in fact, they are working on a model eco-village there. So this isn't just about the short-term movement of stopping the pipeline. It is about the long-term movement of how do we live together. So it really is appropriate to be talking about what is community, what's the future of community in relation to Standing Rock, because this is exactly what they're doing.
Okay, so I assume you met all these amazing people and learned that you would probably like to hang out with them more, right?
And oh, yeah. But there's, you know, it's just like anywhere in any community, there's people you like and there's people you don't like.
Right, right.
Or you don't resonate with. But as we were saying before the break, it's just talking about trauma. I'm convinced that the more we heal, the more we work on ourselves, the more we heal from our own whatever personal chips on our shoulders and or traumas that we've had or whatever those are, that the more available we are to relate to others in a more harmonious fashion, if you will.
That makes sense because you're spending less time dealing with your own issues.
So let's talk about two sides of the trauma. Let's say that both parties are perfect mirrors for each other, but they have different traumas to heal. So what is the trauma that needs to be healed on the part of the builders of the pipeline and the kind of manifest destiny corporate leadership? And what is the trauma that needs to be healed on the part of the Native Americans who feel that their heritage was ripped off from their grandparents and they've grown up in poverty with all of the wounds of their history? Like, you know, what traumas can we address here and how can we get beyond them?
Wow, that's a big question.
Yes, I mean, that's not really our work in a sense. It's everyone's work. Everyone has to heal their own trauma. Like you were in the drama center there, you dealt with people as they came up. You said some people had PTSD.
I mean, I certainly wouldn't ever suppose to go in there and go, oh, well, I'm going to help you guys heal your ancestral trauma now.
That's a little not out of your range.
Well, it's not, you know, it really.
And yet you are calling for it generally without the specifics.
I'm calling for it generally. I'm calling for it for all of us in whatever communities that we live in and where we came from. We all have our ancestral traumas. We all have our historical traumas. And we all have our personal traumas.
Well, wouldn't you say a lot of this, you got to play with emotional literacy when you were there and be able to listen to each other and hear?
Yeah, yeah. And it does come down to a lot of the same things that work. And that is the listening. It's being with each other in a non-judgmental fashion. Just listening and being there as a presence for somebody else that is struggling with something and not condemning them for it and just allowing them to have a space to actually just express and be with the feelings so that they can kind of move through your body and be released. And there's techniques for that I won't go into right now. But that's really the bottom line.
Yeah. I'd like to get back to what the ideal village, the eco-village of the future would be like for you.
Well, the ideal eco-village would be one that was not only built on sustainable principles and alternative energy sources, but also one that had a value of healing for ourselves and each other, that we had ways of dealing with conflict. I see that as being over and over and over the single most important thing in any community. It cannot be emphasized enough, in my opinion, is the need to have some kind of protocols or practices in place when conflict comes up.
And you had that at Standing Rock, right? If somebody had a conflict or an issue, that you had a place where you could go and it was free and you were able to get help.
No.
No?
Not really. I mean, it depended on what the situation was and where you were and within which little hub you were operating in.
Yeah.
But it's apparently, since I've left, apparently it's gotten even more organized. So there are ways, there are meetings, there are councils, there are hoops you have to go through in order to get things addressed. But there's also a lot of messiness, and there's still, I mean, this is really cutting edge. It's, you know, people are figuring it out as they go.
Okay. Hey, we have a caller. You ready to take a call, Julia?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. We're going to welcome Judith from Live Oaks, who wants to talk about the pipeline. Hi, Judith. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Judith.
Great show, you guys. Hi, okay. There's an article I've got. It says, Dapple, investors getting antsy. If pipeline doesn't move oil by January 1st, the contract expires. And it says that it says that. Have you heard that? There's an article here. It's pretty exciting. It says the water protectors have held the ground. Did you hear that?
No, I haven't heard that.
I heard that.
To a specific deadline that the company producing the pipeline is under. If oil is not flowing by January 1st, the two-year contract expires. Go ahead, Julia. Thank you.
That is what my understanding was. Originally, I think it was January 1st, and that was moved to January 20th or 21st maybe now because that's after... I don't know why. Maybe I don't know if that's
the new president. Yeah. Takes office.
But they're definitely they are under pressure to get this going.
Well, what is a truly victorious scenario?
that they just say, you're right, we give up.
I see. Forget oil. Let's just go on. I see.
You know, we have better things to do with our time and money.
It's so funny when you ask the question that way. It's sort of like, yeah, can we actually imagine that scenario? There's so much money built up in this movement. And by the way, the front line now for a lot of people is divesting from the banks and the corporations that are behind the project. So what we're imagining now is that as money is taken, investors are removing their money from the project, that it'll just kind of like take the wind out of their sails.
My understanding is that the oil through this pipeline was just going to go to China.
Yeah, a lot of it was already promised, I guess, to China. I don't know about all of it, but they're in so deep, you know, with this financially that they are willing.
Well, I understand there are like dozens of pipelines across the country, and pipelines have been going on for a long time, as well as this, you know, being a friction point. This is a continuation of an infrastructure that's very deep. Oops.
Oh, did we lose?
Yeah.
We may have lost her.
I think you might have lost her. Do you want to try reconnecting there?
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. So sorry.
That's all right.
Any final comments for the last minute of the show, Julia?
Well, I'd like to just let everybody know that this battle is still going on at Standing Rock, and it's really, I think it has a lot to offer us, not only just in what they're doing locally, but for what we're needing to learn about how to do planet-wide. So just keep your ears and eyes tuned in. And also, if you'd like to find out more about some projects I'm doing there.
Yes, what's your best website or access point?
You can go see me on Facebook, Jule Destrova.
It's JuleBystrova.
Yeah, and I post a lot there. Or I have a fundraiser for a mobile healing clinic that I'm trying to get going over there.
Good. Okay. I hope that's on Facebook.
Last 10 seconds. This is KSCO Santa Cruz and Dr. Future Show signing off.